Benjamin Graham once said that the investor's chief problem, even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself. And I'm going to spend the first part of my talk today going over some things that individual investors do that make them their own worst enemies. I want to start, though, very briefly talking about our intuition for probability. I think that people don't have a very good intuitive grasp of probability. And this either leads to or mistakes that we make in investing, or it basically allows us to make the mistakes because we have difficulty thinking it through. So I'll give a little example here. So the investor's problem is to estimate probabilities when choosing assets, and that would actually include variances and covariances, though even just simple probabilities are quite hard. And then you match with your own preferences and you choose. So here's my simple example. 2 + 2 = 4. Everybody knows that, right? I mean, a 7-year-old kid, if you tell a 7-year-old that 2 + 2 = 3, they'll laugh at you. So it's pretty intuitive. We have a really good grasp of quantities. Now, what about this? A very simple probability problem. If I flip 2 coins, what's the probability that they both come up heads? How many of you think you know the answer? I assume that many of you do, right? How many are very sure they know the answer to this? Okay, a volunteer, Chester, you want to go on? Come on, it's 2 + 2. No, yeah, it's 1 out of 4. No problem. Now we're just going to up it a little bit. 2 + 2 + 2 + 2. Everybody comfortable with what the answer to that is? Right. Okay. We all know, right? Now I'm just going to flip 4 coins. And my question is, when I flip 4 coins, what's the probability that exactly any one of them comes up tails and any 3 of them come up heads? How many think are pretty certain they know the answer to that? You got 2 hands. We have some mathematicians. 3. I flip 4 coins. What's the probability that any 3 of them come up heads and the other one comes up tails? How many don't think that they know the answer to that? We got a few honest people. Okay. Does that mean everyone else does? I guess that means anyone else is fair game here. Okay, Chester, go for it. It's 1 of 4. Yeah, very good. There are 16 possibilities, and 4 of the possibilities. There's 16 possibilities when you flip 4 coins, and 4 of them include 3 heads and a tail. Most people, how many think that your spouse would know the answer to that? Okay, we got two people married to mathematicians in the back. All right, I think you see, probability, you just add a little complexity to probability, and most people don't know how to deal with it. And if they don't have formal training, it's very, very few people without formal training that know how to answer that a problem like that. And I think that that intuitively people don't have a very good grasp of probability, a very intuitive grasp. And that leads to a lot of problems. It leads to a lot of things like assuming that patterns will persist because they don't understand underlying processes and probability. All right, let's move to investors. I want to talk about 3 habits that individual investors have. They tend to trade too often, they hold on to their losers, and when it comes to choosing something to buy, they chase the action. Let's talk about overconfidence for a moment. People tend to be overconfident. They tend to think they have more ability than they actually do. Now, I wrote a paper some years ago looking at it. Basically, it's a theoretical paper, and it just asked the question, how would markets be different if the investors were overconfident? What I found was that overconfident investors traded more, they earned less, they under-diversified, because when you know you're right, what's the point of hedging? Volatility went up in the market, and market depth went up. Now, overconfidence, it comes up in a lot of areas. One of the things I do with my MBA students every year is pass out a questionnaire, and it asks, it says, look around the room, as you might do here. You don't know everyone in this room, but to the best of your ability, estimate how good of a driver you are compared to the other people in this room. Well, out of 50 students, I usually have, in a class of 50 students, usually 20% of them rate themselves in the top decile, in the top 10%. About half the class rates themselves in the top quartile, And usually all but two or three will rate themselves above average. And I asked one student after class a couple of years ago who had rated herself below average, though not in the bottom quartile. I said, so why? I'm just sort of curious. Almost everyone else says they're above average. And she said, well, I was going to mark myself in the top half. And then I thought about it, and I realized that in the last year, I've got three speeding tickets. I've been in two traffic accidents, and I'm currently in court trying to keep my license from being suspended. Maybe I'm actually not above average. But, you know, pretty much everyone else is. And I think the same holds true for a lot of investors. So I wanted to test, you know, you write a theory paper as a PhD student, you can't really expect the world to go out, rush out and test it. So I decided that I would try to do that myself. And I wasn't quite sure how to test to show that, you know, there's too much trading in the market altogether. There's no clear model as to just how much trading there should be. So what I thought is I'd look at a subset of investors and show that they were trading too much. I got trading records for individual investors. This first study was for 10,000 investors at a large discount brokerage firm. Some of the other studies I'm going to talk about are for actually much larger data sets. I looked at these 10,000 investors over a seven-year period, and the question I asked was, when they sell a stock and buy another stock, on average, does the stock they buy outperform the one they sell by enough to cover trading costs? I thought, well, that's sort of like a minimum expectation you'd want to have. Not that it would happen every time, but on average, you'd want that to happen. Otherwise, you know, why would you be trading? Well, I found that even before subtracting trading costs out, the stocks that they bought tended to underperform the stocks they sold over the next year by about 3 percentage points. That's before taking out commissions and bid-ask spreads. Now, some of you are probably thinking, well, there are other reasons to trade, as we, you know, heard this morning. People trade for tax purposes. Might be the end of the year, and you sell something for a loss and buy another stock, and you're not trying to guess which is going to do better. You're just harvesting a tax loss. People also trade for liquidity reasons. In 2 years, my oldest daughter will start college, and I'll probably have to sell some assets to pay her tuition. So that would be another reason to trade that wasn't speculative. So I tried to screen out as best I could all the non-speculative trades. Obviously, I can't do this perfectly, but I used a few filters. For example, I only considered cases where somebody sold a stock for more than they paid for it. So that wouldn't be a tax loss sale. I only looked at cases where somebody sold a stock and then bought another stock within 3 weeks. If you need money for less than 3 weeks, there are much better and cheaper ways to raise it than selling stock and buying stock back. So those were probably not liquidity-driven trades. So I filtered my trades so that as best I could, I was trying to look at speculative trades. And I thought, well, now, when I just look at the trades that people were doing for speculative purposes, they're going to do a little better. But in fact, they did a little worse. Now, the harder they try, you know, the worse it gets. Now the stocks they bought on average underperformed the ones they sold by 5 percentage points over the next year and by about 8 percentage points over the next 2 years. I've replicated this on another data set, and the magnitude of the shortfalls went down a bit, but they were still there and they were still extremely statistically significant. Shortfalls went to about overall, about 2 to 2.5%. All right. Brad Barber, with whom I've written many papers, and I took a look at this idea that overconfidence was causing people to trade too much in a couple of papers. The first one, we just took a really simple approach. We just said the overconfidence theory says that overconfident investors will trade more and earn less. Let's just see if the investors who trade more earn less. So we took 60,000 investors. We had trading records and monthly position statements for them for about a six-year period, 91 through 96. And we divided them up into five groups based on how actively they traded. So you just got five groups, you know, the least active to the most active traders. And then we calculated their average net return. So the returns I'll put up here are net. That's taking out transactions costs and spreads. And what we found was that as people started to trade more actively, our most active investors earned less. So the red bars are turnover, account turnover. The green bars are the average net returns. And the most active investors on average underperform the buy and hold investors by a little over 5 percentage points a year. So we labeled our paper, Trading is Hazardous to Your Wealth. We took another look at the same topic. We got an idea for what I thought, at least at the time, would be a clever way of looking at this overconfidence issue. What you'd really like to do to test the theory that overconfidence causes people to trade more and as a result they earn less is to take a big sample of investors and split them up into the overconfident and the more overconfident and less overconfident ones. Well, we came up with what we thought was a natural way to do this. We did some reading in the psychology literature, and we observed, did some anecdotal observation on our own, and we seemed to find the same thing in the psych literature as what we saw in the world, which was that overall men claim more ability than do women. And this difference emerges most strongly on masculine tasks, things that in our society are sort of seen to be in the male domain, mathematics, mathematical sciences, finance, things where when people were growing up, the boys were told boys are good at this, and the girls were told boys are good at this, and one of the two groups perhaps grew up to be more of a confident than the other. So we thought, well, okay, we're going to divide our sample up into men and women. And our prediction is that men are going to trade more than women, and that this is going to hurt their returns. Now, before we run the numbers on this, I was talking to a colleague and about the study, and I was all excited. I get excited about these things, but we didn't have the answers yet. And he said, wait a minute, you got a problem here. How do you know who's calling the shots? Take my wife, for example. She inherited some money a few years ago. It's in an account in her name. I call all the shots. And I was a bit concerned about this for a few minutes because I was thinking, well, all we're doing, we're classifying accounts on the basis of the gender of the person who opened up the account. How do we know for sure who's making the trades? But then I realized that all that's going to mean is that if we don't get a separation, we're just not going to get a result, and that any result we get is going to be less than it would have been to the extent that you get this cross influence. But fortunately for us, we also knew the marital status of the people in the account holders in our sample. So we thought, well, really, if we're right, then what we'd expect is to the extent spouses influence each other, our results should be even more extreme for single men and single women. So here's what we found. Men traded 45% more actively than women. Single men traded 67% more actively than single women. It could be single men don't have enough to do with themselves, but in any case, they traded very actively. In our paper, we do a number of measures of returns, but the one I think is most relevant is the one I'm going to put up in a moment, where we basically say our theory is that trading hurts your return. So let's see what the effect of trading is on the return. So for every account, we look at what the person had in their portfolio at the beginning of the year. We calculate what they would have earned that year with a buy and hold approach, just no trading. What would that portfolio have earned? Then we calculate what they actually earned, and we subtract the buy and hold return from the actual return. So if the person didn't trade at all, those returns are the same, and the difference is zero. That is what we call our own benchmark return. If the person made some either lucky or clever trades, they're going to have a positive own benchmark return. If they made the other sort of trades, it'll be negative. Not too surprisingly, on average, both men and women underperform a buy and hold approach. However, men underperform by about 1 percentage point more a year than women. Single men underperform by about 1.4 percentage points more a year than single women. All right. I've been talking about buying. Let me talk a little bit about selling. The best investment advice I ever heard came from Will Rogers. Will said, don't gamble. Take all your savings and buy some good stock and hold it till it goes up. If it don't go up, don't buy it. Now, as it turns out, that's kind of hard advice to take, but individual investors follow a corollary on that advice. They buy a stock, and if it don't go up, they just don't sell it. They hold on to it. The tendency to hold on to losing investments and sell winners has been termed the disposition effect. And I did a study basically testing to see the rate at which people realize they're winners and realize they're losers relative to their opportunities. And I find that people realize they're winners at a much higher rate than they're losers. Throughout the year, they're selling winners relative to opportunities at a faster rate than losers. Only in December do you find that people are selling their losers. So, which says that basically they get the slope right. It should be around the end of the year they pay more attention to taxes. But really, you know, if they're behaving normatively, this whole line would be shifted down. And overall, they would be tending to sell more losers than winners. Lest you think that they're doing this because it gives them better returns, I did check that out, and it wasn't working out for them. You might think, well, they bought the stock. You know, I buy a stock, it goes down, and I say to myself, you know, I bought this for a good reason, and when, you know, the other 40 million investors finally figure out what I already know, this thing's going to come bouncing back. It didn't seem to work out that way for these investors. The stocks that they held on to for a loss went on to underperform the winners that they had sold. So, and I don't recommend that people sell losers because they're going to underperform in the future. Basically, I just think people should pay attention to taxes, especially considering how they don't have much expertise on predicting, on stock picking for performance. But you can be pretty sure that you know which of two stocks is going to give you the better tax benefit. All right, buying. Let's talk about buying behavior. Brad Barber and I have a recent paper that we call All That Glitters. And here's the idea behind it. When you go to buy a stock, there are thousands of choices. You know, it's just too many choices to consider, to think about each. You know, human beings aren't very well equipped to go through hundreds or thousands of alternatives and rank order them. I can't go through even 500 alternatives and say, I like this best, this second best, here's my 350th choice, here's my 351st. You can program a computer to do this if you give it criteria, but it's not something that we do well. What we argue is that a lot of individual investors solve this search problem informally and not, you know, probably not consciously, by limiting their search to stocks that catch their attention. And they tend to buy stocks that catch their attention. So let's look at the difference also between what buying means for individuals and how buying is different than selling and how these differences are greater for individuals than institutions. So as I said, when you're buying, there's a big search problem. And what Herbert Simon called our bounded rationality, you know, that we're not all born sort of geniuses with the minds of computers. It sort of limits our ability to deal with this search problem. What about selling? Well, there is no big search problem for selling. Most individual investors hold very small portfolios of individual stocks. In our sample of 60,000 investors, the median number of common stocks held is 3, the mean is 4. You know, even if you've got 8 or 10 or 12, when it's time, if you decide you want to sell something, you can think about each of those alternatives. We can certainly consider, you know, a half a dozen to a dozen alternatives. And individual investors tend not to sell short. They tend not to sell stocks they don't own. It's less than 1% of the positions in our database are short positions. It's probably just as well that most investors don't sell short, but it means that when it comes time to selling, they only have to think about a couple of choices. So there is no search problem. Institutions still have a big search problem, but they got a lot more resources to throw at that problem. They're much more likely to use computers. Admittedly, an individual can also use a computer, but almost all institutions do. They've got more time, more expertise. They're more likely to have rules that help them limit that choice set, either pre-filtering on certain criteria and then looking at a subset of stocks, or maybe saying, we're going to be an expert in a small subset of stocks. You know, we're going to be the experts in biotech stocks that are developing anti-cancer drugs, for example. So institutions, they have more resources to throw at the buying problem. They also have a larger selling problem. There's more symmetry here, because they're going to tend to have larger portfolios to begin with. You know, they might hold a few hundred stocks in their portfolio, and also a number of institutional investors, not all, but hedge funds, for example, often sell short. And once you're willing to sell short routinely, then the universe of potential buys and sells is the same. So what we think is that individuals will tend to limit their stocks, their search. And we think they informally, many of them, not every single one, but many of them just end up thinking about the stocks that catch their attention. So a stock catches your attention, and then you think about, you know, do I like it, do I not like it, and you consider buying it or not. But you still have your own preferences. For example, maybe there are 10 attention-grabbing stocks one day, and I'm a momentum investor, and I decide to buy one of them that's been on a roll. And Moshe's a contrarian, a value investor. And he also buys one of those 10 stocks, but he buys one that's been a little bit out of favor because he thinks there's a real value there. So we both get to, you know, behave within our preferences, but we end up selecting from the stocks that caught our attention, and we ignore the other, you know, 9,000 stocks. So that's our theory as to what's going on. We test it in this paper. We test it by, you know, when do stocks attract attention? We use a few proxies for attention grabbing. One that we use is abnormal volume. Basically, we're saying if there's a lot of trading in a stock on a particular day, probably something happened. We're not saying the trading attracted people's attention. We're just saying it's a sign that something attracted their attention. You know, if I walk down the street, I look down one side street and I don't see anyone, and then I walk down another side of the street and I see a group of people down at the end of this street, and then you ask me on which street was something happening, I'm going to say it's the street with the people. You know, I don't know whether it was good or bad. Maybe somebody had a heart attack. Maybe there was a juggler down there. But that's the street where something was happening. So we say when you see a lot of trading in stock, much more than usual, it's likely that it was grabbing people's attention. It was attracting their attention. Something went on. We also look at extreme price moves. If a stock went up a lot or down a lot, it's very likely that something happened that grabbed people's attention. Even that event itself might attract their attention because it gets reported in the press, the big winners and the big losers. I'm not going to go into too many of the details as to how we construct this study here, but for extreme price moves, we do all of our calculations the day following the news, the price moves. Basically, to get away from the question of whether the investor's buying activity caused the price move or the price move caused the buying activity. So we've got the price move one day and the buying activity the next. It's hard to argue that tomorrow's buying activity caused today's price move. And finally, we look at news. And we do a very simple measure. Either the stock was in the news or out of the news. We use the Dow Jones News Service. So what do we find? We find, which is what we predicted, that investors buy stocks with high abnormal trading volume. Those are stocks catching their attention. Now, you might be thinking here, you know, for every buy, there's a sale, and that's true. But a particular group of investors can be net buyers or net sellers with the rest of the market. So what we're saying is that individual investors are going to be more affected by this attention heuristic. They are going to be net buyers on days that stocks are glittering, on days that stocks are catching their attention. The rest of the market, you know, has to be on the other side of those trades. What we find, what we measure is we basically divide stocks into partitions, into deciles, and here we take the top decile and split it up again. The deciles are based on how actively the stock was being traded, the abnormal trading volume that day. It's the trading volume divided by the average over the previous year. We divide them up into 10 groups, and we calculate the number of purchases by individual investors minus the number of sales divided by the number of purchases plus the number of sales. So were they on the buy side or the sell side? What we find is that as abnormal trading volume goes up, individual investors are more and more on the buy side of the trade. This is for a large discount brokerage firm, 60,000 investors. We also have data. This particular paper, we're using a number of data sets, including some institutional data, which I'm not going to put up here. But we're using the discount brokerage firm. We have data for 2.5 years for 660,000 investors at a full-service retail brokerage firm. And we also have data for about 14,000 investors at a small boutique discount firm. So I think we've got a very large sample from a very large discount firm, a large sample from a very large full-service firm, a good size but smaller sample from a smaller firm. I think we've got pretty representative look at what individual investors are doing. We get the same effect for the large retail brokerage firm and the same effect for the small discount firm. When we go to our return starts, what we're predicting is that individual investors are going to buy stocks that had big moves, whether it was down or up, because those catch their attention. And that's exactly what we find. The individual investors are buying yesterday's losers, they're buying yesterday's winners, they're ignoring the things that didn't do much. That's true for the discount firm, it's true to somewhat lesser extent, but it's still true for the small discount firm, and it's true for the large retail brokerage firm. And finally, when we sort on in the news or out of the news, all three groups are tending to buy the stocks that were in the news more than the ones that were out in the news. I'm not going to put up the table here or the graph, but even when we say split it out into stocks that didn't have a price move that day, so stocks that closed at the same price they opened, we still get all of these effects. They still tend to buy the stocks with a higher abnormal trading volume. They still buy the stocks that are in the news rather than those that are out of the news. Too many cooks spoil the profit. I was going to read a quote here. Oh, here's the quote. I am going to read a quote here. I want to talk for a moment about what happens when, the punchline, I guess, is here already. But what happens when you get people together? I've been talking about what the decisions they make on their own. What happens if you get them together into groups to make their investment decisions? I actually have a couple of papers on this topic, but I'll just discuss the results from one. First, I want to read to you a couple of quotes. One is from the Chicago Tribune in 1994. It says, "The queen of all investment clubs is a group known as the Beardstown Ladies, a group of women from the central Illinois town of Beardstown who averaged close to 70 years old. From 1983 through 92, they averaged a 23.6% annual return, bettering the S&P 500 by more than 8%. In 1991, their portfolio grew by a whopping 59.5%. The Beardstown women have become celebrities. They starred in their own video, cooking up profits on Wall Street. How do they do it? A few years later, in the Wall Street Journal, we read that the Beardstown ladies, the investment club of grandmotherly investors that became popular with the media, announced today that an audit by Price Waterhouse shows their 10-year average annual rate of return was not the 23.6% promoted on the cover of their best-selling book. Rather, it was 9.1%. Well, they had accounting problems. They're a tough thing, as we all know these days. Their problem was sort of this. If you're in an investment club every month or every quarter, you put some money in. And it turns out they were counting that on the profit side. It does marvelous things for your return if you ever have a bad quarter and you need to bump things a bit. All right. We wrote this paper not to pick on the Beardstown ladies, but we had read in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere that 60% of investment clubs beat the market every year. We read this a couple of different years, and Brad and I were sort of scratching our heads and saying, how can this be? There are a lot of studies of money managers and mutual fund managers and how well they do, and the evidence is pretty mixed, but it's right around the 50% mark. It's either like maybe they do a little better, maybe they do a little worse, but there's nobody's claiming that 60% of them beat the market on an average year. Well, we did our study, and we found, in fact, the investment clubs didn't do all that well. The red bars are gross returns. The green are net. Here's an index. Here's an index fund. Here's the gross return for individual investors. They actually did better than the market in gross return because of their portfolio composition. They were in smaller cap stocks in a period that did quite well. But their net return was well below what they would have gotten just in a fund. And the investment clubs got beaten in both respects. I actually think investment clubs serve a lot of useful purposes, so it's not meant to be a knock on the clubs. They encourage savings, they teach people about the market, people make friends, the clubs keep people off the streets. There's a lot of good things that come out of this, but just don't join the club because you think it's a secret to beating the market. Now the question is, where did these reports come from that said that 60% of the clubs beat the market? Well, as best I have been able to ascertain, they were the results of voluntary surveys. Surveys were sent to the clubs every year saying, what was your performance? I don't think anyone lied, but let's face it, you had a great year, you filled that survey out, and you sent it back. And you had a lousy year, you just didn't get around to filling that survey out. And you know, if we let professional money managers self-report their performance for a year, I think we could get 60% of them beating the market as well. All right. Yeah. Okay, what we've got, I actually have a separate paper on that with the psychologist, Chip Heath at Stanford. Brad and I have a paper with him. What we argue in that paper is that in a club setting, in a group setting, people tend to suggest things that are sort of consistent with social norms. You don't, it's kind of like the old thing, no one ever got fired for buying IBM. So they're more likely to come in and say, oh, let's buy Intel because Intel's been doing well, Intel, you know, good management, all of these things. I'm not sure that's why. There's a couple of reasons why they get things wrong. First of all, that probably moved them a little bit out of stocks that did well, though we do risk-adjusted performance as well. But we think that that's what influences a lot of the decisions. The group dynamic is one where you feel accountable if your suggestion went badly, but if other people strongly agreed with you, then you don't feel the same. But I don't know for certain. But we do have evidence in the paper. We have pretty strong evidence that we have a list of most admired companies. And there's a very, very, you know, the Fortune has this list of most admired companies every year. There's a very strong tendency for the clubs to buy the admired companies. You know, people have a very difficult time with the distinction between a good company and a good stock to buy. You know, a well-managed company, good sound management, good product, all these things, you say, hey, that's a great company. But if it's overpriced, it's not a great stock to buy. This is, I used to have my MBA students, we gave them cases, and they were supposed to read the case and say buy or sell. It was a stock analysis class, and often I'd get these reports back on and on about what a great company it was, and at no point would they say, however, it's a, you know, something like it's to buy at below this price and to sell above this one. They would just talk about the fine attributes, not think about the other. Where am I going? Mutual funds, that's an okay place to go. Big surprise to no one is that people put, you know, buy the mutual funds that did well last year. In our sample, 39% of the purchases are of the 10% of the funds that had the best performance the previous year. Over half the purchases are from the top quintile. No surprise. But I want to talk a little bit about why I think people do this. So I'm going to take a little bit of a detour here. We're going to go to the Amazon rainforest, where imagine Moshe and I we're stranded in the Amazon rainforest. Okay? We're not hurt. We're healthy. We're pretty sure we're going to be rescued in a week to 10 days. We've got clean water, but nothing to eat, and we're hungry. We look around ourselves, and we see a lot of plants we don't recognize. I decide to eat this broadleaf plant, which looks at least vaguely familiar to me. Moshe, for some reason, goes for this pointy thing. Well, it turns out I'm very sick all day, and he's got a smile on his face. So the next day, I'm feeling better. I've got my appetite back. He's still hungry. What do you think we eat, or more importantly, what do you think we don't eat? We're not going to eat the thing that I ate and got sick, right? You know, we're not fools. So, pretty clear. All right. 2 weeks later, we're back in the States, we've been rescued, and we decide to go celebrate. Where do we go? We go to Las Vegas. There he is. he's in the money. And we head straight to the roulette table. Moshe puts his money on the black, I put mine on the red. The ball lands on the black, he wins, I lose. What do we do the next time? It doesn't matter. Okay? So what's going on here? We're learning by induction, you know, where you observe what outcomes, but we're also using deduction. And what we're deducing is how deterministic an event this is. So we're pretty sure that when you eat something that makes you sick, there's a high probability that if you eat it again, you're going to get sick again. And we pretty much understand that where the roulette ball lands this time doesn't make much difference for what happens next time. So there's this continuum from deterministic to random. And a question that faces every investor is, where does the stock market lie on this continuum? And what I think is that most investors think the stock market is closer to being deterministic than it actually is. It's not pure random, but it's a lot more random than a lot of people understand. And this goes back to, you know, intuitive understandings of probability. So investors kind of think if the mutual fund did well last year, that's probably the one that's going to do well next year. That's how the world works. You know, if the food made you sick today, it'll make you sick tomorrow. They underestimate the amount of randomness. And as a species, we do tend to find patterns. We tend to see the world as probably more deterministic than it is. It probably makes sense, at least historically, from an evolutionary point of view. If you can imagine being back in hunter-gatherer times, and suppose, you know, there's two hunters out one day, and they're about to go around a big boulder, and they hear a roar. The first one goes around the boulder and gets eaten by a tiger, and the second one runs away. Well, a week later, if that second hunter is out walking and he's going around the corner and he hears a roar, it's a very good thing if he makes a connection. You know, roar, lunch for a tiger, and just turns and runs. It's good to see that pattern. Now, what if he goes out hunting another day, and the day before he snared a rabbit, and he's got a rabbit's leg that he brings with him for lunch. He has a great day hunting. Comes home at the end of the day, all that's left is the rabbit's foot. And he says to himself, this is my lucky rabbit's foot. I will take it everywhere with me because I hunt well with the rabbit's foot. What's the cost to having such a, you know, making that spurious association, seeing a pattern that wasn't actually real? It's not very much. You know, he carries the rabbit's foot around with him for, you know, the rest of his life. It doesn't weigh much, uses up a few calories. Hey, it's even a bit attractive, you know. It's a good-looking rabbit's foot. It might, you know, help him find a spouse. There's not that much downside to making the error in the direction of seeing a pattern that was spurious. There's a big downside. And the other way. Unfortunately for investors, the world's different. The world of investing is different. If investors are constantly seeing patterns and reacting to those patterns and trading on the basis of believing those patterns, they're going to do themselves some harm. You know, they might do themselves a little harm. In some cases, they might do themselves some more. All right, one last thing about mutual funds. Brad and I and Liu Zhang at Michigan have a paper on mutual funds, and we find that investors have kind of learned about loads, that over time they've put less and less money into front-end loaded funds. On the other hand, they don't seem to pay much attention to ongoing expense ratios. And that funds that charge higher expense ratios get more new money relative to their current total net assets. And we think that's basically, again, a part of its salience, that the loads are very salient. People, you know, I gave the guy $10,000, you know, there was a 3% load, and I noticed that money was missing when I got my first statement. I no longer had $10,000. The ongoing expenses, if it's a 2% expense, you know, that's a couple, so what, every, it's less than 20 basis points a month. There's a lot more volatility in the market in that it's not reported explicitly. You know, the prospectus tells you what you're paying. But there's nothing that says every month or every year, here's how many hundreds of dollars you paid in expense ratios. So that's what, I just want to mention that, but I personally think that the investors would be better off with clearer and more explicit reporting of expenses, and probably if they were put in nominal dollars. You know, we went back and forth with one of the mutual fund sort of overall organizations about this, and I had a reporter call me up who talked to them and said, well, they say it's too difficult to report how many dollars, you know, each month or each quarter were spent on the expense ratios. But my feeling is that if you can take the money, you can count it. It can't be that hard. All right. Let me talk about online investing here. I got to get a move on here. Online investing is like the old West, the slow die first. At least that's what a Fidelity.com ad said a few years ago. You know, I read this thing and I I thought to myself, this reminds me of the Westerns I used to watch. And in these Westerns, it's true that the faster draw usually wins the shootout on Main Street. But the another thing I remembered about those Westerns, that when you get to the end of the movie, it's usually not the gunfighters who are still alive. So the question here is it true that, you know, that in the online world, it's the slow that die first? Well, Brad and I did this study, and it's a very early study. 91 through 96, people who switched from phone-based to PC-based trading. I'd love to, you know, do a study with more recent data. I haven't made my data pitch, have I? My data pitch, this is sort of like public radio. You know, you guys listen to, maybe you don't have to do this up here, maybe it's all supported. Down the States, public radio, every couple of months, you know, you're listening to your show and they stop and they start asking for money. Then they go back to the show. They interrupt usually at a high point like this. My data, my data pitch is this. I can't write studies without data. If anyone has any, can in any way help me get data on what individual investors or even institutional investors are doing, trading records. I know it's a long shot, but you got to ask. That's what I need to do studies. I'd really, really like to see what's happened since the turn in the market. So, you know, please find me. I'm not that hard to find. Just type Terrence O'Dean into you know, search engine. I'll show up. My website's on the last slide. But that's my data pitch. Back to the program. So we look at 1,600 people who make the switch and size match counterparts. What we find is investors who go online perform well before going online, accelerate trading after going online, trade more speculatively after going online, and their performance goes down. I'm going to talk about a few things in just a few minutes that are probably different in an online environment, but right now I just want to bring up a couple. One is misunderstanding trading costs. Here in this ad, the passer, this street person says, lost everything doing online stock trading. The passers-by say, yeah, but I'll bet he saved a bundle in commissions. I think a lot of investors don't fully understand trading costs. They know they're paying $8 a trade. They really don't understand the bid-ask spread. Spreads are down, but they're not down nearly as much as commissions. And they don't understand that unless they're a lot different than most individual investors, they're going to end up with some speculative losses. Another thing is self-control. No cookies, no chocolate chip cookies in my cupboard. It's because I eat them. I work at night after my kids go to bed. And around 11 o'clock at night, chocolate chip cookies call out to me. And they kind of find me. And I go and I find them and then I eat them. Now, lest you think I have no willpower, I should tell you that there's a 7-Eleven about a mile and a half from my house. It's open late at night, and I don't go and walk to my car and drive through the rain to the 7-Eleven to eat an inferior chocolate chip cookie at 11 o'clock at night. I do have some willpower, but if the cookie's there, I eat it, so I just don't keep them there. It could be that some investors are better off if, say, they wake up at 3 in the morning worried about the market if they can't trade. They might be better off if they actually have to wait until after they've gotten up and had a cup of coffee and maybe even talk to someone about it for a moment. And so in general, it's possible that making it too easy to trade causes people to trade more. There's no question that lower commissions are better, all else being equal. If you make the same trades and you pay lower commissions, it's got to be better off. But if it tempts you to trade a lot more, then it's not necessarily clear that you're better off. What do we find? We find that here's our size match counterparts. Here's the people who go online. This is event time graph. The missing month is the month of the first online trade. Basically, when people go online, they trade really actively for a couple of months, but that's just trying out a new toy. What we think is more significant is when they settle down to a new plateau. They're much more active traders than they were before. I don't have a slide for it here, but they're also much more speculative traders. What about their performance? Now the red line is their gross performance, the green line their net performance. These are market adjusted, taking out the market return. Here's before and after. After, their market their gross return is about the same as the market's. Their net return is lower. I don't think they lost any ability when they went online. I just think these were people who'd been doing well. They attributed their success to themselves. You know the old saying, don't confuse brains with a bull market. They thought they were geniuses. or, you know, maybe not geniuses, but they thought they were better investors than they were, and they decided to step it up and start trading more actively. Afterwards, they did about the same as anyone else. Oh my goodness. I'm going to just go through this, skip through this really quickly. Basically, we have a new paper. If individual investors' biases affect asset markets, you need two things. Some limits to arbitrage. Basically, there can't be someone who's always got enough wealth and willingness to push prices back to where the fundamental value. But you also need that the individuals are trading systematically, not just one individual doing this, another doing that, but that they're doing the same thing at the same time. We do a study where we take a couple different data sets, but the one is the 600,000 investors, break them up into two groups of 300,000 each, and ask the question, are they doing the same thing at the same time? Are they buying the same stocks? And basically we find a correlation in the same month of 75%, and between what they do this month and next month, it's over 50%. There's this very, very strong tendency for individual investors to be doing the same thing at the same time. It tapers out, the correlations taper out over time, but they remain strong much longer than we thought they would. There are a lot of new people in the market. A lot more investing by households, a lot of recent investors. Between 95 and 98, the number of households investing directly grew by over 30%. People learn about the market from families, friends, financial advisors, books, magazines, and advertising. Of all of these things, advertising is the only one that, except for maybe your family, that finds you without you making an effort to find it. What do they learn from advertising? Oh, okay, so I got to move quickly here. We did a study about advertising, and the upshot is we found that in the late 90s, the advertising in the U.S. investment, you know, brokerage ads, it started to emphasize overconfidence, illusion of control, not such good investment practices, and a lot of humorous ads. And there's evidence that when people are in a good mood, they're more creative and spontaneous, but they're less critical decision makers. Let me just skip through this. Basically, these are the results. I want to talk a little bit about what people learn in ads. You're in control. Data equals expertise. Trading's easy. Anybody can do it. Trading is fun and exciting, and opportunities arise at any moment. You're in control. There's something called an illusion of control that psychologists talk about. When people are personally involved in a task, they think the chance of an outcome is better, even if it's a random task, like rolling the dice. You know, at the craps table, the gambler wants to roll the dice himself, and you might say to him, hey, it doesn't matter who rolls the dice. He's likely to answer, you know, you're right, so hand them to me. You know? There are a lot of ads about control. This one, you whistle and the market comes running. Now, that's a degree of control we'd like to have over the market, but not even Alan Greenspan can do that. Here's one. Prefers to do it alone. Independent, confident, you're ready to trade futures on the internet. You want it all. Speed, convenience, control. I don't know how many of you are financial advisors. Are there any financial advisors out here that would recommend that a, say, 20, 21-year-old woman get into trading futures on the internet without any advice? I don't think so. You're the CEO of your life. You're the one in charge. A lot of these target women. Here's my favorite one. My very favorite control ad goes, I don't want to just beat the market. I want to wrestle its scrawny little body to the ground and make it beg for mercy. Yes. There's a degree of control we'd like to have. You know, she's talking about that roulette wheel, though we'd be recommending psychiatric care. All right, that's control. Data equals expertise. There's a lot of ads that emphasize, you know, more data, you'll be more of an expert. There's a tremendous amount of data available now, especially on the internet. Paul Slavik did, and some other people have done studies where they show as you give people more data, their ability to make predictions doesn't go up much, but their confidence in the prediction goes way up. All right. And, yeah, so that's that. Trading is fun. You want to know here's what E-Trade says about trading. Imagine rolling over and saying, that was better than investing. says, ah, the pleasures of online investing. It is fun. And anybody can do it. This is important because the brokerage firms wanted to get ordinary, you know, people who weren't investing into investing. You know, this is chimp beats Wall Street wizard for second straight year, and you're worried about investing on your own? Come on. Or, you know, hey, when we say anybody can invest online, we mean anybody. Finally, I'm going to show you three very quick video ads. Here's one of my favorites about the idea that opportunities arise at any moment. All you have to do is be vigilant. You can be sitting in the dark in your shorts watching the tube, and, you know, something will be there for you. Oops, where's the volume? All right, so the idea here is they're telling individual investors don't know how they're supposed to find stocks, and what they're saying is don't worry, just pay attention, be ready to trade quickly. You can be watching the tube, and opportunities will be there. This is one of the more interesting, although perhaps insidious, ads. There's just two more here. All right. Let me talk a little bit about this. We missed probably at the beginning. There's two women. The one's a little better looking. The other's a little bit intimidated by the world, the mousy looking woman. She starts off saying, my kids talked back to me at the dinner table last night. First thing we know, she's not in control of her life. She's not the one we want to be like. The other woman says the market's closing. The mousy looking woman thinks it's a supermarket, but of course it's a stock market. They go back to mama's house. She pushes her kids off the computer, click, click, click. Sells a little biotech company and makes $1,700. So she's trading, you know, an under-diversified portfolio of, you know, small high-tech stocks, and she's trading actively, and she's making a lot of money. What's going on, meanwhile, in the house? Anybody, what are the kids doing? They're running wild. They're shooting off these rifles with foam rubber projectiles. The mousy-looking woman is cowering. The other woman, Mama, the one we want to be like, one of these things bounces off her forehead, she doesn't flinch. She is in control in a hostile, male-dominated, warlike environment. You know? She's like, I'm cool, I'm in control. Meanwhile, the woman who none of us want to be like, what's she investing in? Mutual funds. Losers invest in mutual funds. You know? That's what we lose. Okay, what we learn. One last ad. Ads wouldn't be complete without Stuart. Learn here. Investing is it's as easy as It's as easy as falling in love. It's exciting. I mean, Mr. P is thrilled. It's like the fountain of youth. He's now getting invited to a rave. He's thinking of going. But what I like about this ad is that it's socially responsible. Well, because Mr. P does some research. Right. He doesn't do a lot of research. Oh, come on. He does a little research. What does Mr. P buy? Mr. P buys Kmart. So let's see. How is Kmart doing? Here's where Kmart was when the ad came out. Yeah, so these days Mr. P is probably happy that he only bought 100 shares. All right. All of my research can be downloaded from my website. I think I've only got